right, so we were just talking about cognitive behavioral science or cognitive psychology releaser cues. Over and over and over with thin-skinned light bark trees like beech and birch, etc., we see releaser cues like this, right? So if you live near highway overpasses, you declare your love with Krylon. When you're in a national park, you do it, unfortunately, with a pocket knife. So what are we looking at on this particular specimen? So for our recording, what sort of a tree is this? And what's on its bark up to about the 7 foot high reach line with a pocket knife? What are we looking at? It's a beech. And what's carved into it?
Hearts.
Hearts and initials. This one says SN. So, SN, I don't know who that is. I'm sort of a horrible douche canoe of a person. But look how much pitting and scarring. Scarification. So, poorly healed over wounds on the surface of this tree. I want you to take a 360 walk around the tree and see if there's any difference on which faces of the tree have more or fewer scarifications, carvings, old lantern marks, old nail scars, and stuff like that. Very commonly, it's not even 360 even around. What's going on here? Take a look at any of the other trees around out of the same species. Are they evenly scarified all the way around? Or not? And if they are, that's interesting. If they're not, that's even more interesting. So fan out for a sec. Take a look at any of these trees. We'll do a little bit of a sort of a informal stand inventory just for depreciative behaviors on some of these trees. You don't need to be a forester to understand this particular dynamic. Take a look.
Because of the tree, do you think they actually carved it out that wide, or is that
good question? We'll talk about that next. Yeah. All right. So, first question: are these evenly scarified all the way around? No. Okay. Let's speculate for a minute. This is a post hoc analysis. We're not doing a controlled experiment. This is observational field work. But let's speculate for just a second. Why aren't these scarified all the way around evenly? Anybody want to venture a guess?
Trying to be sneaky about it, like staying off the path.
Trying to be sneaky about it, and or this can be multiple motivations here. These are negative motivations, depreciative ones. What else? Trying to be sneaky about it, and what else? Yeah, and or the easiest one. Okay. So, if this path, and this is very possibly true, if this path has been here in some form for the past century, we commonly expect for the nearest side to be the most heavily scarified. It's what somebody who wasn't necessarily planning on doing this sees and is watching as they walk by and they go, wait a minute, I got a knife too, and I'm in love too, so I'm going to leave my mark, and pop goes the weasel. And then on the back side, so that we maybe have a little bit more of a blank canvas and or people can't see us doing it, we have typically some of the deeper cuts, somebody going a little bit slower, carving a little bit harder, taking a little bit more time on the back side. Okay? Does that make sense? All right. Over and over and over, we see this same kind of thing. So, one question that we got as you guys were taking a look at this was, why are some of these carving marks so thick? A lot of these are much thicker than a knife blade pass through. That could be one of a couple of different things. Anybody aware? Anybody take forest health? And have you talked about like canker growth, scarification, bark recovery processes on thin-skinned tree species like beech and birch? Anybody know why this might be? Might be thicker than a knife cut. And in some cases, you can actually see the original knife cut and then this other stuff kind of around it. So in human skin, for example, when you make a cut and it's deep down to like the full, down to, you know, getting into subcutaneous layers and stuff like that, it's not just skin cells knitting back together as that wound heals over. It's also fibroids, fibrous scar tissue that is kind of filling in and sort of lashing that wound closed again as those skin cells reconnect. Okay, so if any of you have like an appendix scar or you know, busted your knee open on a sharp license plate edge or something as a kid, you'll typically have this same kind of a pattern. So the actual incision, if you want to think of it, is like a couple of cells wide. But your body has to grow a bunch of additional cells to sort of pull all that and hold it back together as the skin is re-knitting. Same thing with these, basically the cutaneous layers of this bark, the skin layers of the tree. All right? So you can get a contrast or a sense of the process of this. If you come on over to this side, you can see a newer cut over here. And see, it is moving in the direction of the older cut, the real wide fibroid cut over there, right? So you see how the bark pulled apart a little bit? Remember, these trees are constantly increasing their diameters. So if you make vertical cuts, for example, those, as the tree's diameter increases, those are naturally going to sort of pull apart. They're growing outward and slightly apart from each other as that radius from the center heartwood of the tree increases. Make sense? All right, so the growth pattern of the tree naturally pulls us apart a little bit, and in order to rebridge that faster than it's splitting apart, we got to put in this other fast-growing, typically more fibrous, less biologically functional set of tissue in the cambium, or the growing layers, the living vital layers of the bark, for those of you who are not forestry majors. That area is called a cambium and consists of, what, xylem and phloem, etc. All right. Cool. So all of this boils down to people trying to leave a mark, thanks to so-called releaser cues, because somebody else did it. Somebody else got away with it. And it's sort of a tacit or unspoken endorsement of, this is an okay thing to do here, at least for some people. All right. Questions about releaser cues. All right, so the obvious next step for us in a classroom context is we got the resource, the tree, on our vegetation layer of the park. We've got an impact that's characteristic of recreation specifically happening to this resource in the form of carving, scarification, graffiti, leaving a mark, leaving a trace. We got our four big strategies. What can we do to limit this problem or preclude this problem entirely? We could increase supply, real or effective. We could modify use indirectly or directly. We could harden the resource against use or relocate the use away from fragile resources. Or we could limit use as our fourth and final strategy, either in a limited scope or in a blanket fashion. So, which strategies could we apply here, and what might the tactics specifically look like? This is present on SIU's campus, and this is present all over the place. What do we do? What do we do? Wrap them with an orange netting, like plastic. Yeah, it's super obvious. It draws your eye to it.
Yeah.
but it draws your eye to it in a way that says, hey, this is a problem. Mm. Orange in Western color psychology is a warning color, isn't it? Orange and amber, yellow, like yield signs, caution signs, and traffic. We're all familiar with that. It's a universal Western symbology. Okay. What else could we do? How can we modify use indirectly with information, education, communication, instead of directly by physically blocking off access to the bark to carve? What's a softer, maybe intermediate approach before we have to go putting in jute netting or hurricane fencing, snow fencing? Yeah. We can put up a sign. At some point, we hit a spot where don't feed the animals. Don't carve on the trees. No drinking, no chewing, no spitting, no chasing the girls who do. We have this whole bank of signs and so many messages, and none of them work. Does that make sense? Have you ever been to a trailhead with, you know, a whole bunch of like information and regulations and stuff like that? Did we even slow down to read the signs at the entrance to our campground last night? Yeah, there are signs. Exactly. We'll see those a little bit later over at the closer campground here, Mammoth Cave Campground. So a sign can be pretty effective because we get a couple of seconds of engagement per sign, as long as it's fairly unique in its space. When we have a whole bank of them, not so much. Okay? So that's a situational thing. It can be really effective by itself, but diluted with a whole bunch of others or lost among a bunch of others, it's almost completely ineffective. It's as though the sign is not there at all. All right? What else could we do? We've got indirect and direct behavior modification. What can we do to increase the supply in either real or effective terms of the recreation motivation to be out among these trees? How could we increase the supply in a way that protects our beeches and birches? And some of our elms and like striped, young striped maple, musselwood, other trees that tend to get carved on. Yeah, move the path away from the trees where people want to carve. And where we have trees that have historically been carved, we need to move them real far away so that you can't even see. At a distance of, 100 or more yards, you can't tell that this is specifically carved up with graffiti. It just looks like kind of pockmarked bark. But any closer than that, you can start to make out some of these bigger carvings, and somebody, even a small proportion of visitors, even if it's 0.1% of the people that come through here, well, even a few visitors a year over a century are going to completely cover these things up to about the 7-foot high water mark for carving. All right, cool. So we move the path away. That's expensive. That's hard work. And we might have to cut down some other trees in order to put a new trail center line into place and free up that ground for it. But if that's what we have to do to protect these, yeah, we'll do it. That's for sure. Good answer. Okay, what can we do to limit use to protect these trees? That's our fourth strategy. It's usually our last resort, but what can we do to limit use to address this problem? Not necessarily to solve it. We can't heal these trees anymore, but we can prevent further damage from happening, further wounds from introducing more insects and viral pathogens through the bark at the site of the wound. How could we limit use to address this?
You can encourage people to picnic elsewhere, move them to a riverbed or, some other place.
Yeah. If they can't plant ice here, we shut this down. Period. Yep, you got it. If with observational study, meaning park rangers or researchers or seasonal workers, what have you, stationed on site during periods of heavy use when we suspect this is happening, and just observing use, either personally on site or posting cameras. And you can use very, very simple camera analysis or video analysis software to have a camera look at this tree for thousands of hours and only report back to us the brief video clips when somebody's in frame right next to the tree, and some tiny subset of those are actually carving onto the tree. We can take a look at what are the kinds of visitors doing this sort of thing. We can have a more informed approach based on where is this problem really coming from, really. Is it all people between 10 years old and 18 years old who've got their first pocket knife and they're super excited and their executive function risk analysis parts of their brain, their ethical sections of the brain are still kind of growing into place up until age 25 or so? If that's where the issue is, we can limit use with that specific kind of a user by never scheduling any school groups here, for example. We'll put them somewhere else where we don't have these particularly vulnerable organisms coming into contact with that particular age group's more common behavior dynamic of scarifying trees. Okay? Cool. So we got lots of options, and none of them is automatically the right one or wrong one, but pretty quickly we get a sense of we can put a standardized sign together for like a couple of $100 manufactured, UV stabilized, ready to go, a couple of $100 of labor to put it in the ground, and it's good for a decade. If we jackhammer out this trail, it might be a little bit more money, but that might solve the problem permanently. If there's just no more trails here ever, then this tree is no longer under that kind of depreciatory pressure. So there you go.